It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a reporter tells us what's behind the growing trend of out-of-state companies buying and renting out single-family homes in cities around the country, including Milwaukee. First, President Joe Biden addressed the nation yesterday after former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin was found guilty of murder and manslaughter.
Most men and women who wear the badge serve their communities honorably. But those few who fail to meet that standard must be held accountable, and they were today. One was.
Now, Democrats are renewing efforts to pass a federal overhaul of policing, but Republicans are against a provision of the plan that would get rid of legal immunity for police officers. It's the Week in Washington, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see federal action on police reform? If so, what kind of changes would you like to see? Or do you think changes to policing should happen at the state and local levels? And do you think it's time to get rid of this qualified immunity for police officers? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Jennifer Habercorn covers Congress for the LA Times. Jennifer, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Can you tell us about some of the reaction you've heard in the nation's capital to the Chauvin verdict yesterday?
You know, I was on Capitol Hill yesterday when the verdict came down, and there was a media press conference from Democrats who said that they felt a sense of relief with the verdict, and they were very quick to say that their, relief only went so far because they immediately want to turn to some kind of police reform measure. There was an effort that they tried last year in the wake of George Floyd's killing, and it went nowhere. And there is a little bit of hope that the conviction is going to rejuvenate those efforts and perhaps provide some motivation to renew negotiations. And I should say, Republicans expressed similar support for the conviction, and I think there was a little reluctance on the Republican side to say too much ahead of the actual conviction. And I will say Attorney General Merrick Garland said also today that the Department of Justice is going to launch an investigation into the practices of the police department in Minneapolis.
What kind of things have Democrats pushed for in federal police reform bills in the past?
The biggest issue, as you mentioned, is whether police officers should have immunity. And Democrats are very eager to really reduce the immunity that police officers have right now. That's been the biggest point of contention in the negotiation thus far. It's probably going to remain that way. It's somewhat of an area where there's not a ton of middle ground. But if these negotiations move forward, that's going to be probably the most contentious point of it.
Let's bring on a caller. Tim is with us in southern Wisconsin. Tim, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Tim?
I think we do need to end the qualified immunity just because they tell everybody else. Everybody says if you're not breaking the law, you have nothing to worry about.
Tim, thanks a lot for the call. So that's, as you just mentioned, Jennifer, that's going to be one of the more contentious things in any police reform bill. I understand the president is talking about or is planning to talk about these issues and some kind of police reform when he addresses Congress in the next, I think, week or two. Does mm-hmm. it seem like there's an appetite in Congress, Jennifer, to do something, even if it's not exactly what the Democrats have been pushing for over the last year?
Yes, definitely. And, the protests around George Floyd's murder last summer really spurred that. I mean, even Republicans who had been very reluctant to engage in discussions on police reform said that something needs to be done. But this is kind of the problem that Congress runs into all the time. They see an issue, there is widespread agreement that something should be done, and there is very little agreement on what that should look like. And I think Democrats are going to run into this problem on other issues. Do they take half a loaf? Do they engage in negotiations with Republicans knowing that they're not going to get everything? Or do they fight and, try to get everything they want and know that they could end up empty-handed? It's a little unclear where they're going to land on this one. I could see police reform being an issue where Democrats say, you know, we need to do something, and something is better than nothing.
You followed a controversy that flared up yesterday. Democratic Representative Maxine Waters from California made comments at a protest at a demonstration related to the trial before the verdict came out, saying if there's not a guilty verdict here, suggesting more protests, confrontational protests, she said. And that got the attention of a lot of Republicans in Congress. So what happened then, Jennifer?
Yeah, Republicans immediately said that Congresswoman Waters was stirring up violence and moved to censure her on the House floor. So there was a vote yesterday. In fact, it was just before the verdict in the Chauvin case came down. And Congresswoman Waters, the measure failed. Democrats were able to vote together to block the measure from moving forward. And this really renewed debate that we've seen over the last several weeks about what members of Congress and, frankly, what President Trump, former President Trump, said, and whether they should be held accountable for those things. And, you know, there were some Democrats who were a little skeptical of what Congresswoman Waters had said. They thought it wasn't a great idea that she said it. But, you know, in light of Republicans saying things that they felt like were inappropriate and not condemned for, they felt like they couldn't condemn Congresswoman Waters for what she said. And it really just reengaged that old debate. And it really, you know, there's been a lot of contention on Capitol Hill for several months. And this is just another example of how the parties are just so far apart. They're, you know, there's no sense of camaraderie, and there's a lot of tense feelings up there still.
Go back to our callers now on the topic of qualified immunity. Art is with us in Eau Claire. Art, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'd just like to say that I think people are making a big mistake by ending wanting to end qualified immunity. And I also feel the media has failed the American people by not talking about how much crime has increased since all this has taken place. But nobody's going to risk their life or their job or their home to speed to an accident or to rush to your house because somebody's kicking in the door, knowing that if they get there, that the perpetrator is there and they get out of their car and chase them. Then the person would fight, and then they'd have to physically subdue them, and then they would turn around and get arrested and sued, and their families would be picketed and so on. It's a huge mistake.
And Art, do you have a background in law enforcement yourself?
Yeah, for 19 years. I got out in 2000.
Art, thanks a lot for sharing that. And this, Jennifer, we've heard from different two callers on the opposite sides here of this qualified immunity issue, and this is something we'll be talking about on the show in a little more depth in the future. But this, we're going to hear a lot of these kind of arguments if police reform moves forward, right?
Absolutely. And the caller is expressing a point that a lot of law enforcement and Republicans on Capitol Hill would agree with. I should say Senator Tim Scott, a Republican senator, he has put forward a police reform bill. This is from last year, where he wanted to pursue a type of decertification process for officers who violate the law. It's less than the qualified immunity issue. It's Republicans have backed his plan. He has engaged in negotiations with Democrats. Those conversations are at a very preliminary level. And like I said, this is really an issue where it's hard to find middle ground on, but that's where Republicans are at this point.
Thanks, Art, for the call. We're talking to Jennifer Habercorn with the LA Times about some of the top stories out of Washington this week. Coming up, infrastructure, big plan from President Biden, big but much smaller plan. It looks like it's in the works from Republicans, some of them anyway. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see an infrastructure bill passed by Congress, signed by the president? Do you like the $2 trillion idea or maybe $600 or $800 billion? Bigger, smaller? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our look at some of the top stories in national politics. We looked at congressional reaction to the conviction of Derek Chauvin and some police reform bills in the works. And Republicans are working on a smaller infrastructure plan as a counter to President Biden's. Jennifer Habercorn is with us from the LA Times. You can join in on infrastructure. Call in at 800-642-1234. From what you've heard from the Biden administration, what do you think of their big $2 trillion plan over the next bunch of years? Republicans looking at a plan smaller, but still a good chunk of change. What priorities should there be in infrastructure? What is infrastructure? That's been argued over so far. Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. So Democrats have the infrastructure plan, the Biden administration. First of all, where is that right now in Congress, Jennifer?
So Biden essentially gave Congress a outline of what he wanted to do. And now it's up to Congress to turn that into legislation. And Democrats are very excited about what Biden put forward, but they are at the very basic levels of, the starting line of turning this into a bill. They don't know yet if this is going to be exactly what Biden put forward. They don't know if it's going to be in two parts or passed as one part. They're really trying to talk to Republicans right now. Republicans are going to put forward this countermeasure you mentioned. That's about a third to a half of what Biden said was the appropriate amount of money to be spent. And Democrats are kind of saying, we'll give Republicans a chance to negotiate, but we're not actually sure that they want to. So we're ready to go it alone, which would be a whole complicated process if they try to do that. So while Biden put forward this big plan and there was a lot of attention to it originally, they really have not gotten anything off the ground yet.
And you mentioned that process of going it alone. This would be like the last COVID-19 economic relief package. This would use the reconciliation process. Is that right? Or would this be a different way to get around the filibuster where they couldn't pass something without 10 Republicans unless they did something different?
Exactly. They have to decide whether they do this through the regular process, which means you have to overcome a 60-vote threshold in the Senate. You need to pick up 10 Republican votes, which is obviously would be difficult to do. Or they can go it alone, meaning you pursue reconciliation. You can get around the filibuster, but you're limited in what kind of legislation you can do. And Democrats, at least some of them, believe that piece of legislation, in order to be sustainable, needs to be bipartisan. So they have this tough decision to make. And if Republicans indicate that they're not going to, you know, try to engage in negotiation, there's a lot of Democrats who say, let's just, you know, not spend too much time on them and do something by ourselves.
It's Brianna. Call her at 800-642-1234. Barb is with us in Crivitz. Barb, hi.
Hello. To me, infrastructure means the physical parts. Our bridges, our overpasses, roads, dams are what infrastructure should be. But my question is, how can we fund this? Now, if you think that our government gives so much money to countries all around the world, and if we could, say, by January 1st of 2022, cut that funding across the board by, say, 5% to let countries get some time to adjust, and then in January 1st of 2023, cut it another 10%, it may not be a great amount in the total scheme of funding, but it would be a start. What do you think?
Barb, thanks a lot for the call. So Barb raises a couple points there. First, that question of what is infrastructure? And that's been an argument, right, Jennifer? Republicans more saying what Barb is saying. It's the physical stuff, roads, bridges, and such like. The Biden administration saying, yeah, broadband too, which I think Republicans agree with, and care workers and education. Talk about that debate a little, please, Jennifer.
Yeah, you're right. Democrats have a very expansive view of what infrastructure is. And they say that, you know, their tagline for this is build back better. They say that the pandemic has proven that infrastructure, should mean things like broadband and childcare and making sure families have the support that they need. It's a definition that Democrats have really taken to and really expanded that balloon of what the infrastructure is. Republicans are pretty resistant to that definition. They say that they're willing to spend money on roads, bridges, and as you mentioned, broadband, but they're not willing to say that infrastructure is much beyond that. So that's going to be a big conversation that we're going to see play out over the next several months. And getting to the point, the caller's question on how this is paid for, that's also going to be controversial. Democrats say that that should be paid for by raising the corporate tax rate. Obviously, Republicans are not into that idea. And there are even some Democrats who are not excited to raise it significantly. So that's to be determined. There are a couple other ways to pay for it. There's talk of, per mile taxes for gas and electric vehicles. Democrats are pretty opposed to those ideas, but all of that's going to be on the table in the coming months.
And foreign aid spending estimated usually just under $40 billion a year. We're talking hundreds of billions or a couple trillion. So there need to be some pretty big sources if they want to pay for this as they go, Jennifer.
Absolutely. I mean, as you mentioned, Biden's bill is $2 billion. Democrats typically don't go along with cutting foreign spending, so it's unlikely to be something that they would go for here.
Thanks a lot for that call, Barb, at 800-642-1234. Looking at some of the top stories in national politics with Jennifer Habercorn from the L.A. Times. And let's bring on one more caller with Philip in Fox Cities. Philip, hi.
Hi. Just earlier, you guys were talking about how the Democrats are taking a wide, expansive view of infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And it kind of had me thinking about what infrastructure actually means. And to me, it kind of means that it's, everything you need for you to live day to day, right? Like the bridges is one thing, roads, all that fun stuff. But things like childcare, healthcare, all that fun stuff to me is also infrastructure in that way when you take that wide expansive view. So it also makes some sense to me at least.
Philip, thanks a lot for the call. So Philip there leading toward the Biden administration's definition of what counts under infrastructure, Jennifer.
Absolutely. And again, they say that the pandemic has really proven that you need health insurance and you need it to be somewhat affordable and you need childcare. And I'm sure there's plenty of parents who would agree with that definition.
Thanks for that call. I want to move on to another issue, Jennifer, that you've covered over the last week, legislation in the works related to hate crimes against Asian Americans. What's been going on over the last week?
That's right. Obviously, there's been a spike in hate crimes against Asian Americans, particularly in the last year during the COVID crisis. And so lawmakers have put together a bill that would essentially expedite review of these kind of crimes at the Department of Justice and provide resources to local law enforcement to help them prevent and investigate hate crimes, particularly against Asian Americans. And this legislation is noteworthy not only because of what it does, but because it actually has bipartisan support in the Senate, and it looks like it's actually going to pass likely tomorrow. I'm sure I don't need to inform your listeners that Congress is not the bastion of bipartisan cooperation of late. And so it is noteworthy that they have gotten this done. I mean, we're kind of scraping the bottom of the barrel in terms of, something that everyone can agree on. Widespread agreement that there is, in fact, an increase in hate crimes against Asian Americans and that they should be investigated and that law enforcement should have resources to do so. That being said, just the fact that Congress is able to do this and there's been bipartisan cooperation on, amending the legislation, making it better with contributions from Republicans and Democrats, that's why that's something that I've been following.
I want to give a listen to Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, and he's talking about this bill in an event earlier this week in his home state. Here's a listen.
I dare any senator to vote against this legislation. If they do, shame on them. Shame on them. Because this is what America is all about.
Jennifer, there's like kind of like a hugs and handshakes kind of bipartisanship, and then there's that. That's kind of like a pugnacious bipartisan
right.
call to agree on an issue, even if they agree they can't do it in a nice way.
Yeah, that is a very good point. That there's some things that the bipartisanship feels very kumbaya, and there's bipartisanship that feels kind of forced. And lawmakers typically introduce legislation that's kind of gotcha. It's taking advantage of a situation and saying that it's Americana and apple pie, but adding some kind of poison pill that the other party is just going to hate. And they kind of lob these volleys back and forth, and they say, this is a very simple bill. I can't imagine that anyone would be against apple pie. But in this situation, it is kind of a meld of the two in that, you know, they're still partisans. There's, you know, Republicans and Democrats will say nasty things about the other, but they still want to get it done. So in this way, it is kind of a return to the bare minimum of the Senate working the way it's supposed to, in a way that we haven't seen very often in the most recent history. I'm thinking the last like 10 years or so in the Senate, where absolutely nothing got done, even those apple pie and Americana bills, unless, you know, there was a major crisis that the country was about to default on its debt or in response to the COVID crisis. So the fact that they're able to do this is somewhat remarkable. But again, I'm not willing to congratulate the Senate for, you know, just doing the bare minimum of what they should be doing.
In our last few minutes, Jennifer, what story do you have your eyes on in the week to come?
Well, I think this Asian hate crime bill is going to be interesting tomorrow and next week. And frankly, in the months to come, the most important story in my eyes is going to be this infrastructure bill. Are Republicans and Democrats going to be able to come together to do the bare minimum? Roads and bridges, you know, getting back to Americana, it's pretty Americana for Congress to spend money, particularly when you're putting it out into congressional districts and each member of Congress can go home and say, I helped fix this broken bridge or these railroad tracks. You know, every member of Congress likes to have something like that. So if they can get that moving and get it, you know, even if there's partisanship, if they can get that moving, that's going to be really significant.
Jennifer, thanks for joining us again.
Great to talk with you.
That's Jennifer Habercorn. She covered Congress for the LA Times, and she was with us this week for our weekly look at the top stories in national politics. Coming up after the news, there's been a big change in housing around the country. It's happening in Wisconsin. Find out why out-of-state companies are buying up more and more single-family houses in Milwaukee. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, the head of Wisconsin's Economic Development Agency joins the show to share the details of the new, smaller agreement between Wisconsin and the technology company Foxconn. That's tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum remembering a woman whose life was cut far too short.
Menominee tribal member Ray Elaine Turtelot was 18 when she went missing on the tribe's reservation during the fall of 1986. Tribal police and the FBI found her remains the following spring. Her daughter, Elise Arce, and relative Andrea Lemke Roshan sat down to talk about Ray with WPR's Daniel Kading. They also shared their hopes for a new task force that's focused on murdered and missing Indigenous women in Wisconsin.
My name is Elise Arce. I'm Ray's daughter.
I'm Andrea Lemke Roshan, and I'm Ray Elaine's cousin and friend. Ray Elaine was pure joy. She and I grew up together. We were kids. She lived on the reservation and I didn't. So I loved whenever we would go visit. She was laughing all the time. She was a huge joker and just a really beautiful girl and a really beautiful young woman. And that beauty radiated really from the inside out.
I just know that she was really outgoing and she had a lot of spirit and a lot of lift. She loved to dance. Powwow dance. She was a Menominee princess. She was very into our culture, singing and drumming class, Menominee language.
The time we would spend together, she would try to teach me Menominee. She tried to teach me to dance. She told me I was a hopeless dancer. I never quite could do it, but she was a gorgeous dancer. She did fancy dancing, and that's supposed to mimic a butterfly. And Ray Elaine looked like a butterfly embodied when she danced. It was just really beautiful.
And she was very family-oriented.
I hadn't seen Elise in a few years, and I had gone back up for a family gathering at my cousin Ray's sister's house. And Elise and I, Elise, you were a teenager, but we were on a pontoon boat ride together. And Elise threw her head back and laughed. And I thought, oh, my God, there she is. There's Ray. There's Ray Lane right there, right in front of me.
It's nice to hear stuff like that because a part of me feels like she's living through me. She's always around me all the time.
I remember getting a message saying you need to call home right away. It was in October of 1986. And I called home and my mom was sobbing. She just couldn't even get the words out to tell me that Ray was missing. And I couldn't wrap my head around it because I knew she had just given birth to Elise.
I was only 2 months old when this happened. This was something that kind of shook our whole reservation from what I know, because my aunties kept newspaper clippings and everything from way back then.
We learned that part of her body had been found in a beaver dam on the reservation. So it was very, very hard.
I just don't want any other family to go through what we went through. I see and I know the pain of my family because I can see it in their eyes and how they are.
I think this missing and murdered Indigenous women work is the first time that I feel like there's something tangible that I can do to try to make a difference. We really do want to raise awareness that this is a problem impacting Native women and Native girls, and we need it to stop, and we want it to stop.
It's something that needs to be fixed within the system. And that's why I'm saying, like, I don't want any other family dealing with what we are dealing with. I don't want people going off with cold cases for 34 years. I don't want them to have this pain that we carry around with us every day. That's what I want out of this, because, I mean, and I feel like that would be her only justice of this, is to help other families, because nobody should ever have to feel what we felt.
WPR's Danielle Kading brought us that story, remembering Ray Elaine Turtelot, a Menominee tribal member who was killed in 1986. Her family is participating in the new Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Task Force in Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, if you rent a house and you need to talk to the owner of your property, you might need to call a technology entrepreneur in Silicon Valley, or a real estate magnate in Houston, or a company based in a dingy office in Chicago. Nearly 15% of all Milwaukee rental homes are owned by out-of-state landlords. It's about 6,000 homes. That's up from just 1,500 back in 2000. Most out-of-state landlords purchase homes in low- and middle-income neighborhoods in the city. Why does it matter? A study from Marquette Law School found that out-of-state landlords are quicker to evict tenants and commit code violations more often than their in-state counterparts. We're looking at the increasing presence of out-of-state landlords in Milwaukee, how it's changing Wisconsin's biggest city, and how it's spreading around the nation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you rent a home? Have you been surprised to find that it's harder than you would have thought to reach your landlord, the person who actually owns the property? Have you rented one of these out-of-state owned properties? If you're a property owner, a landlord yourself on the local level, are you seeing competition? Homes getting snapped up by these out-of-state groups? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Carrie Spivak is an investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel who focuses on white-collar crime, gambling, and business. Carrie, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, this is one of those really under-the-radar type stories, Carrie. If you drive around a neighborhood, it's not going to look any different. But below the surface, this trend of out-of-state companies buying up properties in cities like Milwaukee, it's been on the rise. What's going on?
You're right. It is under the radar. Personally, I really wasn't aware of it until I started doing the work on the story. It's happened in a very big way. More about it. That's 2 years ago, homewreckers dealing with them. There you have some giant companies such as Invitation Homes, which owns 80,000 homes. They've kept away from the giants have kept away from the Midwest, possibly because it's colder. There's more maintenance costs, that type of things, and a much older housing stock. But yeah, they've been coming in. I would guess I know many tenants would not know. I mean, and why would you if you're paying your rent to a company called Milwaukee Capital Properties that says Milwaukee? You would not know that that's headquartered in Houston and owned by a man from Peru who lives in Palm Beach. So, yeah, it's been an under the radar, and I don't think even a lot of city officials know about it. The neighborhood groups seem to be more aware of it, actually, when I was doing some reporting.
Now, these are investors, as you say, from Florida or based in Chicago or Silicon Valley. What is it about a bunch of kind of affordable, low to mid-income housing stock in a place like Milwaukee that suddenly puts dollar signs in their eyes? Looks like a pretty good investment.
Property is cheap. It is so much cheaper than California. It's ridiculous. In fact, one woman I talked to, Laquan Shapiro, which is Peachmore Properties, Peachmore LLC, rather. They own 34 properties here. They're preparing to sell them. But she told me that the reason she came here is she had sold some condos in California. That was an investment. Didn't know where to park her money. Did some research and saw these very, very low property costs in Milwaukee. She's never been to Milwaukee, and she bought 34 properties sight unseen, and that seems to be the story with most of the other large purchasers or landlords here. Most do see the property, though, before they buy it, but what draws them here is that price, and the pricing, especially in the Central City area, is incredibly cheap.
Now, if I'm a tenant, do I care? Is my life different if my landlord is owned by somebody who lives on the other side of town versus, you know, the other side of the country?
The landlords would say no, because most of them, not all, but most of them do have local staff here. And why should the tenant care? However, I've talked to tenants and they said, no, it is different. If I'm owned by a big corporation or even a small corporation out of state, and with the pandemic especially, I'm laid off, I'm short on cash, but I think I'm going to have it soon. If it's a local landlord, somebody I've known for a while, even if it's a large company, I have a fighting chance to talk to them, talk to somebody locally, and try to get them to cut me some slack. Out of state, much more difficult because you don't even know who to talk to.
That also came up, you wrote, with repair issues or vermin infestation mm-hmm. issues. What kind of things did you hear from people trying to get in touch with their landlord to fix stuff?
Perfect example. They just, depending on the company, they've had a lot of complaints. Bulldog Ridge, which owns about 180 properties or so. I talked to a couple of their tenants, and they're Chicago area. They're down in Oak Park. They had a lot of trouble getting them to come in and fix it. What's eventually happened is because there were so many problems, the city Department of Neighborhood Services, the building inspectors, put them under special enforcement, which means all their properties were being overseen by one building inspector as opposed to being spread out through the shop. And that building inspector said, yeah, they're doing pretty good now, but they will make the repairs provided the complaint comes from DNS, and the DNS says you have to fix this. Then they do it. Most tenants don't call the building inspector, because for one thing, they're afraid of being evicted. Whether that's legitimate fear or not, that is a fear that they have. So how do you put pressure on these guys when they're out of state? And again, there's nobody that you can really talk to.
We're talking to investigative reporter Carrie Spivak from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about a growing trend of out-of-state companies buying up homes in Milwaukee, lots of other cities around the country, seems like a growing trend, and turning those houses then into rentals, raising some concerns for tenants, communities, and home inspectors. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about how this all works and why it's happening? Do you think it's a concern that there are more out-of-state landlords buying properties in Milwaukee? Maybe going to happen in other communities soon? Do you prefer landlords to be local? And have you rented from one of these out-of-state landlords? Or were you surprised to find out? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Milwaukee Journal Sentinel investigative reporter Kerry Spivak. He looked at the trend of out-of-state companies buying up rental properties in Milwaukee, or houses, and turning them into rental properties. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Kerry, you mentioned that community groups in Milwaukee were, you found, aware of this trend. Do they have concerns about what it means when all these properties are owned not by an individual homeowner or a locally based landlord, but somebody in California or Florida?
Yeah, there definitely are some concerns about that. And it's kind of for the same type of reasons that a neighborhood itself would have concerns. If there's a problem with the house, it's tough to get a hold of somebody to take care of it. You don't have the same interest in the property in the neighborhood as an owner-occupant would. And if you have a company that's overseeing 13,000 properties or 4,000 properties, they're not going to know each property, and it's going to be – it's an absentee landlord. So it's basically everything that goes along – all the concerns, rather, that goes along with absentee landlords, except now it's – even larger, and it's a pretty major corporate scale. And that, you know, there's been a, we did a sidebar about Youngstown, Ohio, where they're dealing with the same type of issue there. And they try to target the absentee landlords and kind of harass them if necessary to try to get them to do improvements and repairs or just to get it up to code. So yeah, it's an issue to the neighborhoods and the neighborhood groups also.
Brianna caller now at 800-642-1234. Lee is with us in La Crosse County. Lee, hello.
Hello there.
What do you want to tell us about, Lee?
Well, I did a stint as a property manager for a while a couple years ago, and I just had a question because the law may have changed since then, but when I was doing that job, I was made aware of a law in the state of Wisconsin that requires if the landlord is not a resident and present in the state of Wisconsin, that they have a property manager licensed in the state of Wisconsin who's physically present in the state so that the tenants have a point of contact also for, you know, eyes on the property for proper management. And I'm just wondering if that's changed or are these out-of-state ownerships illegal?
Lee, great question. And Kerry, at least from the ones you talked about, it sounds like they had at least some kind of local property management, these companies?
For the most part, I don't know what the state law is. I know in the city of Milwaukee, you are required to give the city a contact person. Does not have to be living in Milwaukee or the Milwaukee area, but it has to be somebody that DNS can contact in case, or the cops or whoever is necessary in case of a problem. But like I said, it doesn't have to be somebody who's physically living here.
Lee, thanks a lot for the question. And you, Kerry, talked to somebody who had worked as a property manager for one of these companies. Does it sound like it was a smooth experience for them?
Well, I've talked to a few of the property managers. It depends. Some of them, you know, enjoy it and think they're doing a good job. Others, not so much. But the tenants are the ones who would have the complaints about that, about being unable to reach somebody.
And you also, we've mentioned housing inspectors a couple times. There are concerns that they want to talk to the owner. And at least in one of those cases, the owner said, don't call me, basically. Can you share that story?
Oh, Sergio. Yeah, in fact, now I'm remembering, too, that I talked to his local manager, his former local manager. Yeah, she complained a lot because she said she would call Sergio Pajovis is his name, and he lives down in Palm Beach. and there would be complaints about the properties and things that she would want to have repaired, and he would not authorize, she said he would not authorize the money. She's kind of caught between the tenant and him. She was not permitted to give the tenants the phone number of Sergio, probably not even his name, because the tenants had never heard of him. And yeah, one time a building inspector called Sergio down there in Florida, and Sergio said, basically, talk to Patricia in Milwaukee. You know, it's leave me alone. He didn't use the words, but the message definitely was leave me alone.
Do you think this trend is going to continue? Like, because when I first heard about it, you mentioned Aaron Glantz's book earlier, and I had talked to him about it a couple of years ago, and it seemed then like it was more of a coastal thing, and now we're seeing it more and more in the Midwest. Is the notion that this is going to get to be a bigger and bigger business?
I don't see why it wouldn't. They have a trade. Their trade association's only 7 years old, but there is a trade group now. There's the returns that you can make are pretty good. That's the other reason. Highgrove Holdings, which has over 130, I believe, properties in Milwaukee. They're out of Torrance, California. They're looking to eventually have 1,100 properties in Milwaukee. They say on their website that the rental properties in Milwaukee provide, I'm quoting, provide tremendous cash flow of 12 to 18%. Returns annually, and then they go on to say, quote, each property generates a gross annualized return rate of just over 20%, and in some cases have exceeded 30%. Those are the type of profits you turn running a casino. I mean, why would the trend not continue, especially in places like Milwaukee where the property costs are so low?
Let's bring on another caller now. Vivian is with us in Green Bay. Vivian, hi.
Hi. My experience, my children are in Denver trying to buy a starter home. I have friends with children in Seattle trying to buy a starter home, and they're not available. And when they are, they're very expensive, and they seem to be swooped up by cash offers. So young people are not getting a chance at home ownership because of these rental corporations.
Vivian, thanks for the call. In our last minute or so, Carrie, is that a concern that if these companies are buying up the houses, the young people looking for that starter home, as Vivian's kids are out of luck?
That is an excellent point. Yes, it does drive the prices up, and it makes it very difficult for a young couple or an older couple or individual to buy a starter home or a small property, or even the wave, this is very common, Milwaukee, buy a duplex, rent out half of it, which helps you pay your mortgage. Those properties can be getting I can't say for sure, but there's a possibility that they will be priced out of the market. Yeah, that was an excellent point.
Vivian, thanks for that call. And Carrie, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again today.
Hey, it was my pleasure.
That was Carrie Spivak, an investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel, who focuses on white-collar crime, gambling, and business. He joined us for a look at the growing trend of out-of-state companies buying up family houses, single-family houses in Milwaukee. Now, this has been happening around the country, and then turning them into rental properties. If you have experienced this yourself, found yourself renting a house from a landlord that turned out to be from a place far, far away, send us a note. Tell us about it. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. You can follow Carrie's reporting on this at jsonline.com. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, Wisconsin has a new scaled back agreement with the international technology company Foxconn. We'll look at the new agreement and some of the risks that state and local governments can take when they provide incentives to businesses. And as Oscar Awards approach, we'll take a look at the best part of many movies, the music. Join in with your favorite movie soundtracks and scores of all time. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Baseball season is in high gear right now, and there's a big story coming out of Milwaukee. Central Time producer and Brewers fan Bill Martins is into it. Hey, Bill.
Hey, Rob, got to talk about Corbin Burnes, one of the Brewers' starting pitchers. He's just been unbelievable in his four starts so far this year. Turned out another spectacular performance last night against San Diego. Six innings pitched, no runs, no walks, and 10 strikeouts. Just another day at the office for him. He's been beautiful.
And this is kind of coming out of nowhere, right? I don't think people were expecting this kind of performance from him. Can you tell us a little bit of the backstory?
Yeah, so he was he's been with the team for, I don't know, 3 or 4 years or so, and showed a lot of promise in his early days. But then the wheels just completely fell off in 2019. I don't know what happened, but they tried moving him to the bullpen and then to the minor leagues and then to a pitching facility in Arizona where he got LASIK eye surgery and worked with a mental skills coach. And he got it all back. He was phenomenal last year, and he's picked it up another notch this year. So it's great to see.
From the numbers here, Bill, this isn't just like, yeah, he's having a pretty good season. He's having just like a sick season, right? I mean, this is amazing numbers.
Yeah, it's filthy. Look it up. I don't have time to go into the details, but trust me, there's a lot of great stuff with Corbin Burnes pitching again this Monday against the Marlins in Milwaukee, so check him out.
We'll watch for it. Thanks to Bill Martins. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.